is what we did yesterday.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the SIPS observations, and I'm going to first just tell you a little bit about the data set, because part of what I want to do is anybody who isn't using the data set, I'd love for you to use it. And then just talk about some of the variations on different time and spatial scales. So the question with regard to this workshop is really, you know, how can we really help contribute to trend analyses, given that AIM is obviously a very short mission? And I think everybody with short missions would answer this really the same way. What we hope to do, of course, is figure out the physical basis of some of the PMC variability so that then we can apply those concepts to the long-term data sets or models. Okay, so the SIPS data set itself, if you wanted to go get the data, it's at this URL here, which I have at the end of the talk as well, and obviously you can just email me if you want, or Google it. We're at version 4.2, revision 5. So if you've been using anything less than that, you'd probably want to get updated data. And just to remind you, the way the instrument actually works, we have four cameras that view in the nadir. And as Matt said yesterday, we only have one wavelength, 265 nanometers, but we look at different scattering angles in order to derive the phase function of the cloud scattering. We have a resolution of 25 square kilometers, basically 15 orbits a day, to cover the polar region. Okay, so the publicly available data, levels 2 and 3, we have products. Level 2 is orbit by orbit files, so we give the retrieved cloud parameters, the albedo, radius, and ice water content in every single 25 kilometer square pixel over each orbit. So you would get a file of data on an orbit by orbit basis. And these just show what an orbit, you know, plot of, say, the albedo would look like, the radius, or the ice water content. And if you're interested, this was Gerd's suggestion, if you're interested in just getting the geolocation data, just to see what we have without having to download a whole bunch of data, we do have those in separate files. Okay, and then level 3, there are several flavors of this data. Level 3A. Our daily files, and basically, you know, if you plot it up, this is what this looks like. We consider this to be a quick look product, not something that you would actually do science with, because we average together our ascending and descending nodes, so you lose all local time information. So, but it'll tell you, you know, where the clouds are, give you some idea of how bright they are. Level 3B is a similar thing, except that it's just made into movies, so you would get a season-long just one season-long file that you could just look at to get a very quick look of what a season looked like. Okay, level 3C, this is a data product that probably most people who would look at the data would maybe start with this in terms of real analysis. They're season-long files, so you would get a file per season. It's binned in latitude, so we have 1 degree latitude bins. We also have options on this where we can do, say, solar zenith angle or local time binning instead of latitude binning. And again, it has all of the orbit by orbit cloud parameters in it, but binned in latitude. Then we have level 3D products. These are if you're interested in looking at SOFI in conjunction with SIPS. It has all of the data from SIPS that's in the common volume that's viewed by SOFI. And then finally, a new product that we're just coming out with now is the 3E product. And this is for, in particular, people who are maybe ground-based observers. You know, you have an instrument or photographs or whatever. What we're doing is we're providing files that only have the SIPS data at your location, within 100 kilometers of your location. So you don't have to download all of the SIPS data if you don't want. You can just download it for your particular station. Right now we have, I think, 12 stations in there. If anybody has a favorite station, let me know. We might already have it in there. If not, we can add it. Okay. All right, this is just basically a summary of the frequency that we've seen for all of the seasons so far. Northern hemisphere in blue and purple, and then the southern hemisphere in the warmer colors. You can see in particular the southern hemisphere has a lot of variability within the season and from season to season. You see this orangish line here, that's the Southern Hemisphere 9-10 season. The blue and purple are a little bit more similar. Very high frequencies in the middle of the season.
Could you remind me the threshold to which you determine the positive?
Okay. So for what I'm showing here, we look at the albedo, and if it is above 2 times 10 to the negative 6 per steradian, we count it as a cloud. It's pretty robust, our false cloud detection. We would have very few false cloud detections at that threshold. If you use one, it's a little more iffy. Okay, what this shows is just season average PMC frequencies. So for all of the seasons that we have, frequency is in black relative to the left-hand scale. And then I'm overplotting the MLS temperature at 0.005 hectopascals. Over here, this is, this is the temperature here. You can see a very, very good anti-correlation, as you would expect, except for this one year, 2009, 2010. Over here is the same thing, except now I'm plotting water vapor on the right-hand axis. And here you can see a very good correlation, which is, of course, what you would expect as well, except for that one year. So 2009, 2010 is an anomalous year. It was the year that I showed on the last slide began very early compared to the other years. We understand some of what's going on, not all of it. If I just repeat those plots, but now only include February for the 2009-2010 season, don't include the rest of the season, then you get back this very, very nice anti-correlation with the temperature and a correlation with the water. So omitting the beginning of the Southern Hemisphere 09-10 season brings it back into line with what you might expect for the very bulk properties. We know that there were high frequencies in early 09-10 that were caused by these early winter to summer stratospheric wind shift right below the clouds. So Anne has written about this. Bodil Carlson wrote a paper on it. And Susanna will talk about this kind of mechanism, I think, right after me. So now, the interesting thing about this, though, is that this was affecting the very beginning of the season. We're talking about an effect, though, that happened for 2 months, in December and January, that caused that lack of correlation or anti-correlation here. So it's a very long-term effect, and I'm not sure if I believe that all of the season onset is actually being felt all the way through January, but maybe it is. Okay, now I'm moving and looking at variability during the seasons. So in this plot here, I'm plotting the SIPS frequency, except that it's a residual versus the MLS temperature, again, residual. So I've just de-seasonalized it and I'm looking at the difference between the actual observations and then the seasonal variation. In this case, I'm looking at the Northern Hemisphere 07 season, and I'm showing the clouds at a latitude of 80 degrees, and I'm also looking then at the MLS temperature at 80 degrees. And again, you know, you see a pretty nice anti-correlation, as you would expect. Here I'm looking at the exact same thing, except now it's the Southern Hemisphere 08 season, latitudes of minus 80 degrees. Okay, I have this note, the PMC frequency variations are often anti-correlated with local temperature variations throughout the season. It usually looks pretty good, but you get a lot of times when the correlation is kind of iffy, and that's, you know, it's got to be water vapor coming into this, as well as poor data. All right, now though, I'm going to switch. And looking at, this is Northern Hemisphere 07 here for the clouds, again in black, and then Southern Hemisphere 11 for the clouds in black. But now I'm looking at the opposite hemisphere correlations. So the red here, the clouds are at 80 degrees latitude or minus 80 degrees latitude. In red here, I'm looking at the MLS temperature residual in the southern hemisphere at 70 degrees. And here, I'm looking at it in the northern hemisphere at 70 degrees. So these are the interhemispheric teleconnections that Bodil has written about. But the interesting point I wanted to make here is that, first of all, I think it's clear that winter hemisphere variations are driving the variability throughout the season. You don't always have the same phase of the comparison, but you can tell just because of you know, you have the same cadence, that something is going on. Sometimes it's extremely well correlated, sometimes it's extremely well anti-correlated. When Bodel wrote her paper on the Southern Hemisphere 07-08 winter, she was able to show that there's a time lag between the opposite hemisphere forcing that depends on the altitude of the PMCs, because it just takes a different amount of time for that signal to get across to the other hemisphere down to a particular altitude. So we think that's probably what's going on that's making this change in time, whether or not you have a correlation or an anti-correlation. One thing that I certainly don't understand, we haven't looked at this in detail, is the fact that here it's correlated well at the beginning, anti-correlated at the end. It's just the opposite in the southern hemisphere. But the other thing I also really wanted to emphasize was that while we might expect the southern hemisphere to have these kinds of interhemispheric teleconnections because the north is so variable in the winter, as Dave has shown for at least one season, the southern hemisphere, even though you don't normally think of it as extremely variable in the winter, it clearly is causing these kinds of variations. And this happens in many winters, not just one. In fact, this actually shows the northern hemisphere. This is all of our northern hemisphere winters with the southern hemisphere winds. And while it looks kind of messy here, it's still, the cadence is right there. I think there's a clear signal going on there. Okay, oh, this is in the southern hemisphere where it's even clearer, which you would expect. But again, so this is the stratopause temperature in the opposite hemisphere. Okay, I think that one of the real strengths of the SIPS data is that we do have so much coverage. And so you can look at spatial variability. You can look at it on different timescales. I don't have slides where I'm actually going to show it on a whole bunch of different timescales. And in fact, this is really very much average. So here I've averaged together every single January of all the data that we have, and here all of the July data that we have. Even here, you can see that there are asymmetries. It's not totally symmetric about the pole, and this is most likely due to the gravity wave activity. Amal has written about this. Mike Taylor has written about this. And so you can clearly see it even in an average over all of the months. I think that there is probably some local time things going on here too. But okay, so now though, moving one step in temporal resolution, now I'm showing every single January from the different years. And so this, we're looking at southern hemisphere here. Here's the total average. You can see that these were moderately bright clouds. This is just the albedo that I'm plotting. Very bright in January of 10. That was the anomalous year that we've talked about before. And then dim again in January 11 and 12. Okay, if you look at the MLS temperature, you can see that just from the temperature, you can understand why there were dim clouds in 11 and 12 compared to the other years. What you don't see, though, is anything anomalous in the temperature in southern hemisphere for January 10, which would explain why it was so bright. That just says that. Okay, but the water is consistent with this. So I think that there's got to be, it's temperature and water. I guess I wouldn't be ready to say that it's primarily water, except for this one season, I would definitely say that. So then I took, again, Mark's model and said, okay, you know, what will that actually give me? Of course, whether or not his model works well is going to depend on the data that you feed it, right? You got to get your temperature and your water vapor. So this is based on MLS, and it's just the, I'm plotting here ice water content, so it's exactly what we derive from SIPS, although this was actually albedo plotted here. But in any case, you can see that with that increased water, even though the temperature didn't change, you definitely get an increase in what you would predict for the ice water content. Okay, looking now more carefully at the 0D model, here I have SIPS data. This is an average of the ascending and descending nodes, so you have two local times in here. And I'm plotting it versus what I calculated using NOGAPS data, because I think NOGAPS, they assimilate MLS and SABR. I think that they have a chance of doing a better job than just looking at something like MLS. And I haven't scaled anything, and you can see that it looks pretty good in terms of overall colors and stuff. The patterns aren't in the right places, but I'm doing, you know, an average here of ascending and descending. Here I took, they have 6 hourly output. I just averaged it together. There are huge local time variations in here. And so I wouldn't necessarily expect to get all the patterns right. It's something that I'd really like to look at, though, because I think that with this kind of model, you could do it really well. Anyway, so, you know, kind of in the ballpark. I can tell you, though, that there were other times when it wasn't as much in the ballpark, and I didn't bother to show them. Anyway, it's a work in progress, but my main thought was just, you know, when and where can we apply the model? I think that it's an interesting question to ask. Where is it really good? Okay, I wanted to just very briefly talk about local time differences. We can use the SIPS data to look at local time differences. You have to be a little careful, but this shows in the northern hemisphere our ascending and descending nodes, and then in the southern hemisphere our ascending and descending nodes. So we're, you know, roughly 10 to 12 hours apart in, you know, basically at noon and midnight. And I was looking at the latitudinal extent of the seasons, like Jim was talking about, and I just started plotting it out by saying, I just wondered how many days do we see PMCs as a function of latitude? And what I did is I said, I'm going to count, if we have more than 5% PMCs on any particular day at a given latitude, I count that as a PMC day. And then I just added those all up. And, you know, for the most part, you see exactly what you expect, you know, very few at the low latitudes, and it gets higher and higher at the high latitudes. One thing you'll notice, though, in these red curve and in the green curve, it's a double-valued curve. That's because we go, you know, on the ascending node, we cross a particular latitude, and on the descending node, we cross a particular latitude. All of these curves have two parts to them, but only in those two seasons did we actually see a significant difference in them. I don't know what that is. I believe it because it shows up even when I use a very high threshold where I know I have no false detections in here. So it's just an interesting question that I would definitely like to understand better, and I think we need to understand this to understand trends. Anyway, if you look in the northern hemisphere, you get curves that look like this, basically.
Presumably it's local time type of effects.
Right. That's because this here is the ascending node, and this is the descending node. So they're separated by, you know, 12-ish hours, 10-ish hours, something. Okay. I've actually shown this before. I think I showed this at AGU several years ago, but since we were talking about bright and faint clouds, I wanted to bring it back up again. Do they vary differently? Do the bright clouds vary differently than faint clouds? So here I'm just showing SIPS frequencies in Northern Hemisphere 07. This is our ascending data. But you can see that there's a very nice anti-correlation between the bright clouds, which are in the red, and the faint clouds that are in the blue. I did not divide these in half. It's not like I took the top half and the bottom half. These are the faintest we could get was still good statistics, and then the brightest we could get. So one thing to keep in mind, of course, is because of this behavior, it means that when you're plotting things versus bulk temperature and zonal averages, you're going to get opposite dependencies on temperature. You know, you're going to get the bright clouds correlating and the dim clouds anti-correlating, or vice versa. So it's just something to keep in mind when you're interpreting data. SIPS is not the only one who sees this. This has been seen in Snowy, in Sophie, in OSIRIS, where the brightest, you know, say the brightest 20% and the faintest 20% always anti-correlate, and with very good anti-correlation or correlation coefficients. It's basically, I'm not going to go into this, but I think everything is consistent with just a conversion between large and small particles, if you make the assumption that the large particles are bright and the small particles are dim. And certainly we can show, I have an extra slide if anybody wanted to see that, but I don't think it's anything astounding, but it's kind of interesting. Okay, so then just to summarize then, first of all, we have a lot of data. It has high spatial resolution, a lot of coverage. I would urge anybody who has an interest in it, contact me or anybody on the team, and we'll get you set up with some of the data. So the overall SIPS variations can often be explained simply by, you know, the large scale temperature and water. But quantitative explanations, detailed mechanisms are really needed. I think, you know, looking at it very superficially, things seem to make sense. But when you start looking at the details and quantitatively, there's a lot of questions. The intra and inner hemispheric teleconnections, I think, are a huge forcing of the clouds. And if we're going to model the trends, I think we have to get it right, which means we need to get the gravity waves right. And I'm sorry I missed the modeling stuff yesterday. So I don't know if you guys talked all about that already, but I think that the trend analyses should be performed on specific parts of the season. Certainly, you know, like the dim and the bright clouds, they show the correlation or anti-correlation in the middle of the season, but not at the edges of the season. So the trends may be very different. Certainly, there are different mechanisms that are controlling things, and people should look at bright and dim clouds separately as well. From what I'm seeing with the SIPS data, the local time effects are changing from year to year. I mean, even in terms of whether you have them. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but I don't really understand it. So again, that's just the website here for you to come visit. Thanks.
So, I mean, I think my personal opinion is it's that the when you look at those averages and you see that asymmetry, that it's coming from non-migrating tides. And there's no expectation that the tides are going to be the same amplitude from season to season. And I think that that's probably where you should look first. Talk to people like Damien Murphy and those guys that are measuring non-migrating tides for their networks and see if there's any correlation between tidal variability and brightness.
Why would they be almost non-existent in some years and actually have a very significant effect in others? What's going on to modulate them? I'm not a tide person at all, so.
Ruth and is Ruth here? But she'd probably give you the best answer for that. But we've seen lot modulations by the QBO and by the SAO
and possibly by planetary waves in the winter hemisphere.
That was what I was wondering, is if there was a planetary wave forcing of this that made the winters different, and therefore that changed how the summers were responding.
But
Anne's is really in the summer. I mean, it's the winter stratosphere to summer. Oh! Not the one that you were talking about with the ozone hole.
No.
The other one. Okay. Yeah.
Any questions?
I was just wondering if you could remind us what you think the latitude extent where you have good signal in the noise is
for the SIPS data.
Yeah, that boundary, is that determined by signal noise, or is that the farthest in latitude that you
it's going to be determined by our sensitivity. Of course, on the ascending node, we could have seen farther in latitude, except that there's no sun there. But on the descending node, we actually do see. You know, we'll make measurements down to 45 degrees or something. But at 50, I don't think I have seen really. 50 to 55 degrees, except for if you do a special processing. So what Jim was showing, where Justin took the data and did a special processing of it, it's not operational, he's able to pick out the clouds. But in the operational processing, I would say 55 to 60, we're going to see some good ones, but you have to be careful about it. It's not that, because we'll see false detections there that are going to compete. Whereas above 60 degrees, I think we're pretty good.